We're talking about brutal working conditions and labor atrocities in the palm oil industry and the pervasiveness of palm oil in the products we use every day. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Glad you could be here. The Associated Press, it did a massive investigation last year, visiting more than 24 plantations in Indonesia and Malaysia and interviewing over 130 workers. What do you want to know about conditions in palm oil fields and the connection to big banks and the products you buy? Have you intentionally tried to avoid products that use palm oil? How did that go? It's 800-642-1234. Margie Mason is an investigative reporter for the Associated Press. She and colleague Robin McDowell won an award from UW-Madison Center for Journalism Ethics for their investigative series on palm oil labor abuses. Margie, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi, good morning. Thank you so much for having me.
Good morning. You probably get this a lot, but I felt so conflicted reaching for the Dove soap this morning. Can you give us... Yeah, can you give us a sense of the range of products that palm oil is in?
Palm oil is so ubiquitous. It's in so many different things. It's in everything, as you mentioned, from Dove soap to Hershey's and Nestle's chocolate. It's in Girl Scout cookies. It's in paint. It's in explosives. It is an extremely versatile oil, vegetable oil, and it largely comes from two countries, Indonesia and Malaysia. And even though it touches your life in the donuts you're eating this morning or in your coffee creamer, most people, you know, a lot of people haven't heard of it.
It can be disguised on labels, I understand. What are some of the other names it goes by in product ingredient lists?
You know, you can find, there's a lot of very scientific sounding names that you would have to look. We've got a whole list of names that are extremely long that you could find it in. But also there's, you know, sometimes you can see it'll say palmic acid or some form of the word palm. And that's a clue. But it doesn't always mean it's palm oil. It could be, you know, coconut oil or something else like that. But normally, if it says palm, there's a good chance it's in there. But oftentimes, again, if you're looking at the back of your shampoo bottle, you'll see all this gobbledygook and these long names that you can't even pronounce. And there's a chance it might be in there as well.
So Southeast Asia, Malaysia, and Indonesia, these countries start to really ramp up commercial production of palm oil in the 60s and the 70s. What did palm oil replace? What was going on then?
Well, at that time, these countries were really trying to find, in their case, a golden crop. And so it was really important to them. They latched onto palm oil and found that it was very lucrative. And at the same time, you know, there were a need for different types of fuels. So it's now being used in Europe and elsewhere as a biofuel. And here in the United States, you know, and elsewhere as well, trans fats, there was a ban. We all remember the trans fats ban to try to eliminate that from our diets. And so palm oil just kind of was the nice, easy thing that was cheap and abundant to substitute in for that. So that's what we saw happening in the U.S. And most of us didn't even know what happened here.
Yeah, and I didn't even realize that Malaysia's government, way back in the 50s, they created FELDA, the Federal Land Development Authority, with this intent of, you know, giving jobs to the rural poor in the palm oil industry. And this grew to become the world's largest state-run palm oil agency. What is the role of FELDA in the palm oil industry?
Right. So FELDA is, as you mentioned, a big one. And it was set up, you know, there were lands set aside, and it's still run. It has a commercial arm as well, known as FGV Holdings. And basically today, it is still one of the major players. And as we found in our reporting, there are problems there with labor abuses. We found a lot of different issues, including a man who, you know, was being forced to sleep in the jungle because his passport had been taken from him and then expired. And he was an Indonesian man there, you know, essentially there illegally because his paperwork wasn't, you know, up to date. And he ended up escaping. But yes, Felda is a major player, and as is, you know, FGB Holdings.
We are learning about human rights abuses in the production of palm oil, an ingredient found in about half the products on supermarket shelves, most cosmetic brands. Margie Mason is the investigative reporter at the Associated Press, and you can join in. Have you tried to avoid products that use palm oil? Has that been difficult? What do you want to know about the industry? 800-642-1234. Bill is joining us from Milwaukee with a question. Hi, Bill.
Good morning. Good morning. I'm glad you're talking about this. This is not the first time that I have heard about the exploitation of women and children and all kinds of ancillary horrors as a result of the palm oil industry. What I would not come from a protest generation. I remember when we went after Nestle for a while when I was in college because we didn't like the way they were treating people in Central America. Mm-hmm. I want to know who are the major purveyors of palm oil in the United States, who are their products, and we the people should stop buying them. It's just that simple. We as consumers have great power in this world, and if we decide to turn somebody off, they will go off.
Bill,
if we eliminate them, it will eliminate the problem.
Yeah, Bill, thank you for that. Do consumers have leverage here up against these multinational companies, Margie?
Well, I think that's a very good question, and it's one that I get asked a lot. Unfortunately, you know, palm oil is so, it's found in so many different products, and we like to say that it is too big to fail at this point. You know, he mentioned Nestle. So Nestle uses palm oil, but so does PepsiCo and Procter & Gamble and Unilever. You know, you can basically pick out any major, you know, huge food or cosmetics company in the world, and, you know, they're probably using some form of palm oil. So at this point, you know, it's found in so many different places. It's difficult to just say, I'm not going to use this or I'm going to give it up. It's very hard to boycott.
When you look at the abuses, the labor abuses, you talked with more than 130 current and former workers. What did they tell you? What stories stay with you?
You know, I think one of the things that stays with me is that we talked to all of these workers across vast stretches of Indonesia and Malaysia. And in doing so, we basically heard the same stories over and over again. You know, there's a lot of issues with women not getting paid the same as men and not being given full-time positions, basically being on kind of a day, you know, worker or piecemeal type of situation. Oftentimes, too, the quotas are so high. They're given these daily quotas that they can't reach the quota. So the man will have the job, but he'll end up having to bring his wife and in some cases his children to the fields to help as well. And they work for free so that he can meet his quota. So this is the type of thing that we heard over and over and over again. Again, the passports being taken, you know, people feeling trapped, and in some cases, people being outright enslaved and forced to stay and work on a plantation for no money under threat of violence.
We're talking with Associated Press investigative journalist Margie Mason, who uncovered, as she said, child labor, horrific working conditions on palm oil plantations in Malaysia and Indonesia. It's documented in her on-the-ground reporting. Do you think it's up to companies or consumers to stand up for fair labor practices? How can the two work together? Have you seen these working conditions firsthand? What do you want to know about the inner workings of the palm oil industry? Join in 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Margie Mason on the Ideas Network. We're talking about the palm oil industry produced from the fruits of palm trees and conditions for workers on plantations in Indonesia and Malaysia, the world's largest producers of palm oil and found in so many products we're learning we use in our life. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. An Associated Press investigation last year uncovered palm oil companies operating in tropical Southeast Asia exploit children, along with severe labor atrocities like forced labor trafficking and slavery. What products have you taken a stand against because of deplorable labor practices? Be part of this, 800-642-1234. The Associated Press investigative journalist behind this work, Margie Mason, is with us for 10 more minutes. Tim is joining us from New Berlin, going to the Girl Scout cookies reference. Tim, go ahead.
Yes. Oh, it sounds like you've already heard about this, but about 3 or 4 years ago on one of those feel-good stories at the end of the network news, they talked about these two Girl Scouts who brought attention to the higher-ups in the Girl Scouts about palm oil being in the cookies, and these girls were recognized and given credit, and I think some kind of an award, for pointing out this abuse. And it certainly sounded like Girl Scout cookies were going to stop using palm oil, but we bought recently Girl Scout cookies, and sure enough, it's right back in there. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering if you knew, it sounds like you know something about this. What do you know about that, please?
Tim, thanks. Margie.
You're right, Tim. There were a couple of girls who worked on this issue, and Girl Scouts came out and they made pledges and they said they were going to move, or their bakers were going to move to a sustainable palm oil, which is a palm oil that's basically, it checks a lot of boxes that this roundtable on sustainable palm oil, which is this you know, body that people are members of. The Girl Scouts moved to this type of regulated or more sustainable palm oil. But the problem is that with labor abuses, what we found is that on these plantations that had this seal of approval from the RSPO, there were still labor abuses happening. And so we actually found a little girl in Tennessee who was interested in this issue as well and looking at the sustainability of it. And she was looking mainly at the environment. And when we started telling her about the labor issues, she became extremely interested in that as well, especially with children. We found child labor directly connected to the supply chain of Girl Scout cookies. Mm. So she's now taken this up and has been really, trying to force change within the organization. And there's a lot of other girls who have joined forces with her.
Can you look to other industries that have worked to end inhumane labor practices? I mean, thinking of the production of coffee or cacao for chocolate, or even the Forestry Stewardship Council. I mean, is there a pathway here of reform?
You know, I think, again, the palm oil industry, because it is so big, it's going to take a lot of work to try to make change. There are millions of people working in this industry. It is extremely labor intensive. And so I think, there is certainly, there's been a lot of work done with, as you mentioned, cocoa and some other, commodities. But with palm oil being, again, so large and I think entrenched, this has been going on for generations now. We literally found people that were 4 or 5 generations on one plantation. So it's going to take a lot of change, and it's going to take a lot of will, both, for the companies who are buying this product, this palm oil, but also for the governments who are involved and the banks that are financing it.
And we're going to get to the banks in a moment. We're talking with Margie Mason from the Associated Press, and she won an award from UW-Madison for an investigative series on palm oil labor abuses. You can join in with your questions, 800-642-1234. Margie, you say that this industry is too big to fail, and it reminds me of the big banks, right? Who is financing these plantations?
Well, what we found is we looked at different banks, major banks and financial institutions, everyone from, you know, HSBC to Bank of America, Citibank, the Vanguard Group. And, you know, what we found is that they all are in some ways financing, or the money is either going, you know, in some cases directly to palm oil companies, or it's being routed through, you know, one of the biggest banks in Southeast Asia, Maybank. And they're, you know, one of the biggest financers of the palm oil industry. So, you know, we looked at that and, you know, wanted to call that out because, you know, the banks also have, you know, a lot of them have, you know, a responsibility, and they make it very clear that they don't want slavery or child labor or anything connected with, you know, the projects that they're or funding. So in that particular, you know, case, we looked at this and we found pretty much all roads were leading from the major banks in some way to the palm oil industry.
Would the banks talk to you? Did they have a position to tell you?
A lot of the banks basically just came back and pointed to whatever their policy is on, you know, child labor, forced labor, slavery. And most of them do have, you know, most of them do have some kind of policy in place. But again, the question is, you know, if you have a policy, is it, you know, is this policy actually working, or is it just there, you know, for window dressing? Because again, we put a lot of money, including, you know, from, you know, teachers' pensions and things, was actually ending up in the palm oil industry.
Margie, this is a bit of a reporter's notebook question, I suppose, but how did you talk with the workers? I mean, you mentioned the worker, you know, living on the jungle floor, sleeping in the jungle. But how did you come in contact with these workers?
Well, I think there were a couple of different ways. We approached people sometimes on plantations if it was safe for us to go in and meet with them. But oftentimes, you know, we had to be very careful, and we did not reveal any of the, you know, identities for the workers in our stories to protect them. And so we would have people meet us oftentimes outside, sometimes, you know, late at night. And we would meet in coffee shops or hotels or, you know, anywhere we could to kind of, you know, get as easy for them and as safe for them.
How did you earn their trust? How did you, you know, get them to talk with you and that you would be able to, they would be able to trust you with their stories because their life is in danger?
Right. I mean, you know, it took time, and I think really it was more about building trust with the sources and people that they trusted. You know, once we kind of, you know, made clear what we were doing and the purpose of what we were doing, and we tried to, you know, ensure everyone that we would do our absolute best to, you know, keep anybody's identity from being known so that, you know, no one would lose their jobs or, you know, have other things possibly happen, like being deported, or in some cases, even we worried about violence. You know, that was the main way. So this type of reporting takes a lot of time. This was over 2 years of reporting, and it really came down to, you know, source building and just being in the field and really going back over and over and over again, because we just didn't have the data. It wasn't like someone handed us a stack of papers and said, hey, here are these secret documents, write about this. We really had to do this from the ground, from scratch.
Margie, trace for us, how did these workers get trapped in this industry in the first place?
I'm sorry, you just broke up. I didn't catch that.
How did these workers get trapped in this palm oil industry to begin with? How did their lives, you know, lead to this?
Well, you know, it all stems from poverty. Robin and and I spent many years living in Southeast Asia. And, you know, these are people who are from very poor places in Indonesia, in Myanmar, in Cambodia. And so they're looking for opportunity. Bangladesh, you know, they want to better their lives. They want to better their families. And so, you know, the industry, especially in Malaysia, there's a real shortage of workers. And, you know, they can't find people within the country to do the jobs. So people from outside come in. And often they come in under terms that they think they're getting. And it's turns out not to be the case. And they end up being stuck and exploited and abused. And this happens not just in palm oil, but in many industries, unfortunately.
Margie, thank you for your reporting and thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Margie Mason is an investigative reporter with the Associated Press. We have a link to her series on palm oil labor abuses. It's at WPR.org/mornings. Ahead this hour, we explore the debate over vaccine passports. Should proof of vaccination be required for certain types of travel or to get into large gatherings? Or what about the office? 800-642-1234. News update is next on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Wisconsin is being hailed as a national leader in the COVID vaccine rollout, but access remains uneven. The state's racial, ethnic, and other minority groups face major barriers to inoculation. Bram Sable-Smith reports on efforts to reach these communities.
Barbara was thrilled to learn that she and her parents would qualify for COVID vaccines in January. The 28-year-old education student lives with her parents in Milwaukee, and all three share caretaking duties for Barbara's young son, who is on the autism spectrum. WPR is withholding her last name because of her parents' immigration status.
We got a letter from the health department just stating that we, as a household, qualify for that vaccine just because of we are taking care of a child with special needs.
Barbara has shouldered more caretaking duties during the pandemic because her parents work outside of the home in fear exposing the child to the coronavirus.
So it was a relief for me that they were going to be vaccinated and get close to him.
She quickly booked three appointments at Walgreens, but when they showed up, she says pharmacy staff turned away her parents because their IDs were expired. Barbara herself presented two current IDs, but says she was asked for additional proof of residency.
I'm not sure if they were questioning my immigration status, but they were questioning my residency.
Her residency, that was right there on the ID. The family decided to leave. A corporate spokesperson for Walgreens said they could not comment on Barbara's case without a privacy waiver, but noted that while they check to make sure the right person is there for an appointment, state-issued IDs and U.S. citizenship are not required to get vaccinated. Still, Barbara's experience highlights the barriers that are fueling disparities in Wisconsin's vaccine rollout, even as all adults become eligible in the state starting today.
There's been a lot of messaging for folks to call this place or register online, you know, all of these different things. And people are not thinking about the people that don't have a phone right now, right?
Melody McCurtis is deputy director of Metcalf Community Bridges in Milwaukee. Last month, eligibility was expanded to 10 Milwaukee zip codes in an effort to reach more minority neighborhoods that have seen a larger share of COVID cases and death. But Metcalf Park was left out, so her group brought vaccines to the neighborhood. McCurtis is canvassing door-to-door to make sure residents know about the aid events where they can get a shot. All they need to do is show up.
And we're hopeful that folks are going to come out and get the vaccine now that it's in a walkable distance.
The Mung Institute in Madison is also hosting vaccine clinics. That's where 56-year-old Suvit Tao got his first dose in March. Sitting in a waiting room where a Hmong language video gave information about the vaccines, Tao answered questions through an interpreter. He says he's looking forward to being able to go out more once he's fully vaccinated. The clinic is held at the Life Center Church in Madison. It's a familiar location for many elders in the community. The Hmong Institute runs a culturally and linguistically accessible mental health program here. CEO Peng He says it's important to provide a familiar space like this for Hmong elders. Many face trauma around vaccines and medical care before arriving in Wisconsin as refugees. In some cases, Herr says, military forces in Laos would round up villagers for mass vaccination events.
And so you fast forward to now when even the testing site at Alliant Energy Center, right, the National Guard was there to help, right? So then obviously that helps triggers a lot of the things that they witnessed and saw back in Laos.
In Milwaukee, Barbara was able to find vaccine appointments for her and her parents, albeit a month later. It's frustrating, she says, because she knows many Latino residents are facing similar hurdles.
A lot of us want to get vaccinated, but we're not given the option to get vaccinated.
As of April 1st, Wisconsin's percentage of vaccinated white residents was twice that of Latinos and nearly three times that of Black residents. Bram Sablesmith, Wisconsin Public Radio.
And that story comes from a reporting partnership between WPR and Wisconsin Watch. Now to vaccine passports. What do you think about a system to require people to prove they've been vaccinated against COVID? Join in, 800-642-1234. Glenn Cohn is a Harvard Law School professor with expertise in bioethics and health law. Glenn, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, give us a working knowledge, if you will, of vaccine passports. We're hearing about them. What are they?
Great question. So vaccine passports is what is commonly referred to, but it's a bit of a misnomer. These are essentially proof of vaccination that might be used by the federal government, by a state government, by a private employer, by a commercial entity. So I prefer the term health passes or digital health passes. Other people use the idea of licensing. And the idea behind them is that for certain kinds of things in the economy or in society, maybe that's crossing a border. That's what the EU has been talking about using it for. Maybe it's about returning to a particular workplace or going back to a university. We'd require proof of your vaccination status and also track what kinds of vaccines people have received and when they've received it.
Yeah, in this digital health pass, as you call it, you know, it really reminds me of a digital wallet, not just verifying your vaccination status, but also keeping track of your COVID tests, your results, you know, logging positive or negative results. How do you envision an app built out like this with your health data on COVID?
Yeah, so I think we should be careful here in that the question is what data should be contained in it. So there is a question about whether your vaccination status really is health data as we traditionally think about it, right? We're not asking you for your medical records. We're not asking you for your family history, for your comorbidities. We're asking you essentially to show us that piece of paper, if you're lucky enough to have been vaccinated, that you received. And I can tell you for many years traveling the world, it's extremely common to have these little books about yellow fever or hepatitis showing your proof of vaccination that you have to show when you cross a border to sub-Saharan Africa or East Asia or the like. So the idea is we could make this a lot easier through an app that recorded this information. We've seen Israel already do this. The EU is beginning to roll this out. New York has a pilot project called the Excelsior Pass for going to see a sports, for example, or a concert. And the idea would be that we would basically have a central repository where you could include proof of vaccination. And then rather than having that little card, when required, you could just show the app. And one nice thing about this, if it's done properly, is it means you don't you're not at risk of losing your little card. And perhaps more importantly, we can defend against forgery or other kinds of problematic ways of circumventing such a system.
Yeah, and we'll get into forgery and fraud in just a bit. But let's bring in Mark in New Berlin. Mark, hi. What are your thoughts on vaccine passports?
Good morning. I was going to say that I'm undecided, but listening to this a little bit, I'm totally against it. I'm totally vaccinated, at least for COVID and for flu. But who decides what conditions allow you to be able to move in society? Is it if somebody decides later that I didn't get a flu shot next year, that I won't be able to go to a sporting event or a grocery store? Well, I don't understand who could decide this. Yeah. For us. And I've seen in this, if you haven't learned anything from COVID, you've learned that the medical opinion changes over the course of a year.
Very fluid.
And
yeah.
It's really scary, especially with the administration we've got right now.
Mark, thank you for that. And I want to ask you then, you know, who takes the lead here on a system like this, Glenn?
Yeah, so my own view. So thank you, Mark, for the question. First of all, just to put this in context, as I've said, we've been doing this for a long time when it comes to international travel. This is well established. What most Americans might not know, though, is that actually historically in this country, we've had similar regimes for smallpox. So if you go into the late 1800s, early 1900s, it was the case that many employers, miners, factories wouldn't let you work there unless you could show that you had a smallpox inoculation or you could show the scar, which proved that you had had smallpox. So this is, you know, just to say, historically, an old idea. I think there's a lot of sensationalism over the term passports. But the idea that there are certain things in a society you can't do unless you can prove that you can do them in a way that won't put others at risk is a very traditional idea. Think about a driver's license, right? The fact that we require people to show competency to drive. That's because we don't want them to put others at risk on the road or themselves at risk. And really, that's what the essential idea behind these digital health passes are. Can we basically have people indicate that they are at lower risk so that we can begin reopening America? And are they a less restrictive alternative than the idea of keeping things on lockdown and not letting anybody back to work or anybody back to university? And they're an interim step. But I hear what you're saying about the slippery slope and the idea. I'll just say that I think that, you know, one of the great things about the political process is that the politicians hear from voters like you. And there is something of a check there in that I think the governor, for example, might have a very different attitude towards COVID than he would for influenza. But there are some workplaces, you think about nursing homes, for example, where maybe it is important to show that you are vaccinated against influenza.
Well, yeah. And then you mentioned the slippery slope. I mean, it's a nursing home, or is it enrolling in a public school or going to a Badger football game or boarding an airplane? And, you know, as you say, this comes down to how much risk should people accept to respect the rights of Americans who don't want to get vaccinated?
Yeah, but it's not just the rights of Americans that want to get vaccinated. It's also the rights of Americans who don't want to be infected with COVID or don't want to pass away. And again, I think that the important thing is that it's not about restricting people's rights simpliciter. Mm-hmm. It's about a less restrictive alternative than the idea of shutting down Badger games or shutting down the University of Wisconsin and making all the students be virtual. Would it not be better to say if there are students who can be there because they are lower risk, we should open the doors to them at least? So it's not against liberty versus pro-liberty. It's a question about deciding what the least restrictive alternatives might be.
Let's bring in Joe now in Weston with thoughts. Joe, hi, go ahead.
Oh, good morning. So we go on a yearly trip to Canada fishing since like 1984. And I know the director of tourism at Sunset Country up there in the region we go, and he's telling me already that Canada is looking at strongly at verifying COVID vaccination before you can enter the country when the border does finally open. So, I mean, you can harp all you want about liberties down here, but it won't do any good if you want to fly to Switzerland or go to Canada fishing with a group of guys. I mean, and as far as liberty goes, like, look at motorcycle helmet laws. And in there, in that case, you're not hurting anybody else except yourself if you don't wear a helmet. Why weren't people crying about laws to have to wear a helmet? You know, I mean, you get fined if you don't wear a helmet in many states. So it doesn't fly as far as people saying personal liberties on a lot of things, you know.
Joe, thanks. What do you make of an analogy to motorcycle helmets?
I think that's a helpful analogy. I mean, seatbelt laws are the other. But I think the important point that the caller just made is that if those laws are justified, these are even more justified. Those laws are just about protecting yourself from danger. These are about protecting others as well. And again, the idea is the state is not saying we're going to tie you down and jab you in the arm if you don't want to, but to say, just as with public schools where we require the kids to have certain kinds of vaccination, in certain settings where you're being unvaccinated might increase dangers, we're going to say if you want to enter them, you should have to do vaccination or wait it out till we get to herd immunity. choice you have for yourself. And I think it's just a question of what we as a decent society require people to do. And, you know, we have a long history of requiring vaccination for travel, for school, for the like. This is just expanding the pool. But I do agree with the prior caller that who decides is vitally important. And I am afraid that we're going to get into a world where you have thousands of employers, thousands of businesses having to make their own decision.
Yeah, and I'd rather see the private sector. Yeah,
exactly. I'd rather see government coordinate at least to some extent so that we don't have this much fragmentation.
Glenn Cohn, our guide, he's a Harvard Law School professor. Scholarly work at the intersection of medical ethics, healthcare law, big data. Do you have privacy concerns about sharing if you've been vaccinated for COVID or not? When do you think proof of COVID vaccination would be warranted? When does it cross over into government intrusion? 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's get back to our conversation about vaccine passports. President Biden's top health advisor, Dr. Anthony Fauci, told Politico Dispatch yesterday that he doubts the federal government would mandate vaccine passports, but
there may be theaters that say you don't get in unless you have proof of vaccination. There may be colleges or other educational institutions that do that. I'm not saying they should or that they would, but I'm saying you could foresee how an independent entity might say, well, we can't be dealing with you unless we know you're vaccinated.
Harvard Law Professor Glenn Cohn is with us for 10 more minutes. Let's take another call now. Jeff is with us in Delafield. Hi, Jeff. Go ahead.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. Interesting program. I've been listening for maybe 15 minutes, and I'm going back and forth. I tend to think that having proof of vaccination is a good thing. However, I can understand the other side of it, that it kind of gets back to this, just this hyper partisanship we have in government today. And let's face it, so many people just don't trust government anymore. So I think if we had more trust in our institutions and they garnered more trust in the populace, more of us would be on board with, let's say, doing the right thing. That's my comment.
Jeff, thank you for that. Glenn, what do you make of that and having more trust in government to do the right thing?
I think the caller identifies what I view as a real tragedy of this pandemic is that public health has become a politicized thing. Now, you know, there's always been politics over things like tobacco, let's say, and the like. But the idea that there's a global pandemic and we view this through our tribal lenses of red versus blue is really, really sad and something that I think when historians look at this period of history, they really will find puzzling. Now, one thing I'll say that's interesting to me is that the Kaiser Foundation just did a survey. They do these periodic surveys. One thing they found was among groups of people who said they're in the wait and see mode about getting vaccinated or in the definitely against mode of being vaccinated, when you tell them you may not be able to get on an airplane if you're not vaccinated, they change their mind about their willingness to get vaccinated. Hmm. So there is a way in which some of this private efforts to require passports or this idea that people will have different kind of opportunities to engage with the world or the public may actually shift people's behavior towards vaccination. So I think that's interesting. And maybe that in some ways, seeing this will help, you know, destroy some of these differences, these divisions in our society. But who knows?
How do you, though, put safeguards in place around unlawful discrimination and these health disparities that we see? I mean, unless you have a fair and equitable system for administering vaccines, wouldn't a passport concept just deepen the disparities?
Great question. So two separate questions. On disparities, I think you're absolutely right. And before we introduce these, I think we have to be in a position where we feel as though all Americans have an opportunity to get vaccinated. We're not there now. We're getting much closer. And we're also, as you know, some of your reporting has suggested earlier in your hour on the news, we're in a position where we're actually needing to reach out to minority communities in particular rather than waiting for them to come to us. But the good news is we are reaching a place where in the U.S. at least, we will have access for every American who wants it. But that's in the U.S. What do we think about low and middle income countries where there hasn't been a single vaccination yet? Mm. The idea that these people across the world will be prohibited from our shores or from, you know, coming here or from entering the United States. Think about students, foreign students, for example. That's really upsetting. And that's why I think any rollout of these kinds of passports, especially in terms of internationalism, has to be coupled with a commitment to making sure that we are providing vaccines to these hard-hit countries. On discrimination, your second question, here I just want to indicate that all of this is subject to the oversight of civil rights statutes like the Americans with Disabilities Act and also Title VII for employers. And what that means is, when it comes to employment at least, if you have a medical contraindication, a disability such that you can't take the vaccine, your employer is required to give you a reasonable accommodation. If you have a religious objection to taking the vaccine, your employer is required to consider a reasonable accommodation. So a scheme like this that has this as a general rule can still make room for the idea that there's individuals who, for whatever reason, just can't go through with the vaccination. And we can do both. We can walk and chew gum at the same time.
We're talking with Glenn Cohn, who's a Harvard Law School professor, bioethics and health law expert, as we look at the ethical and political issues. Let's go to Kia now in La Crosse. Hi, Kia.
Hi. I just wanted to ask if the passport would apply to include people who have had a documented case of COVID. Because as a nurse who works in urgent care, I've been starting to see a lot of people who've had negative reactions to the vaccine, especially if they've had COVID prior. And now my coworkers and I have been chatting that we've been testing less people positive for COVID than we had people coming in with vaccine reactions. Hmm. So to the analogy that the caller made about not wearing a helmet, I'm of the opinion that the COVID vaccine, from what I've seen in firsthand experience, can have negative physical consequences for some people. And like the actual disease being Russian roulette, you're not sure who's going to get really sick and who's just going to be fine. It seems to be the same way a little bit with the vaccine. Ethical about it being mandated.
Kia, thanks. Kia has concerns about the ethics, as we've been talking about, of having a mandate in place and the side effects of the vaccine. And also, as we look at the variants that are now circulating, and how would you people with a vaccine passport ensure the credentials that the protection is still valid?
Yeah, this is another reason why this passport is a good idea, to be perfectly honest. It's because we can track with the information about when you were vaccinated and what vaccine you got. We can basically use that information to update as we see new variants emerge. If we learn that one of the vaccines is less good as to one of the variants, or its durability has worn off after a certain period of time, by having this information centrally deposited, we can adjust the status of determining if you need a booster or something like that. Mm. That's why it's crucially important to have centralized information on who's been vaccinated by what vaccine when. And that is an infrastructure we don't really have a great system for here in the United States compared to our peer countries, if I'm perfectly honest.
Glenn, thank you for joining us.
It was my pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
Glenn Cohn is a Harvard Law School professor, bioethics and health law expert. Stay with us next hour as we discuss how screening practices for lung cancer have changed for smokers, with a pulmonologist and radiologist as our guide. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.